I'm here with Ken Griffey, Reds Hall of Famer and member of the Big Red Machine, who has a book, a new book called Big Red, Baseball, Fatherhood, and My Life in the Big Red Machine. Welcome, Ken. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure being here. It's a nice little walk up here. I took a nice little stroll, but I enjoyed the walk.
Yeah. Well, you know, your career in baseball has been remarkable, you know, the things that you've done, the things that you've seen. And you grew up, I know, in Denora, Pennsylvania, a town which I've been to, actually.
Oh, okay.
And because I have relatives in Pennsylvania. But, you know, it's an old zinc mill town.
Right.
And I wonder if you ever, I mean, did it ever occur to you as a kid growing up that you could achieve what you have achieved? And how did you end up getting drafted by the Reds?
Well, the first question, you know, I never dreamed that, you know, ever play Major League Baseball or anything else. I might have thought I was going to school, go to college for football, but baseball was kind of far away from me. What happened was I had a friend, his name is Elmer Graves, was a scout for the Cincinnati Reds. Mm-hmm. And one of the few scouts in that area, because you know it was big Pittsburgh Pirate area. And
sure.
They had this, the main scout there was a guy named Joe Consoli. But Elmer was a football and basketball referee. And that's what he seen me, you know, he seen me most of the time was playing football or basketball. And mm-hmm. He found out that I played a little baseball in high school. So he got one of our coaches together, Mr. Jay Giddick. He was my baseball coach in high school, and he asked Jay if I, you know, if they can try me out. And we were in a little town right up the river from Denora, Manassas. It was called Fayette City. They had a little baseball mm-hmm. field right near the river. And I went there, and he ran me in the 60-yard dash, which I ran about 6'3".
Yeah.
And then he hit some fly balls, made me throw a little bit. But he wanted me to hit against a guy named Doc Medich.
Mm.
And Doc Medich was the big-time
yeah.
University of Pittsburgh pitcher at that time. And I got a couple of hits off of him. I hit one out of the ballpark, you know, over the fence and stuff. And then about 3 weeks later, I had another tryout with him. Same thing, but we had a simulated game with Doc. And I hit another home run off of Doc Medich. And after that, he asked me a question. He said, if we draft you, would you sign? And I was struggling with the fact of playing football or a little bit of basketball. And then, you know, I wasn't hearing very many scholarship offers, and I thought I would have a lot more, but I guess I didn't.
You wanted to go to Marshall, didn't you?
Yeah, Marshall was one, and University of West Virginia was the other. It was mm-hmm. two of my best friends were. Well, one was my cousin, and the other one was Bernie Galifa. He was a quarterback at the University of West Virginia. But anyway, Elmer said, if they draft you, would you sign? I said, yeah. So they called me about June the 2nd or 3rd. And my mother answered the phone, and she said, they want you. I think it's the military. Because when Elmer said something to him, he's just been drafted, you know. And she didn't know. She had no idea.
Yeah.
It was, you know. So anyway, I talked to Elmer. And I didn't know what round. He didn't tell me that. He said, the only thing we can offer you is a jock strap and a pair of sanitary socks. And that was my bonus. So
that was the bonus.
That was the bonus.
And it was the 29th round.
29th round, yeah. And yeah. There was 30 rounds.
Yeah.
But the other kid never even, you know, I think he went to school, whoever he was. I can't even remember his name. But he went to school when I was the last one to sign for the Reds that year.
Denora, you know, obviously Stan Musial came from
right.
Denora, too. So it had
Joe Montana.
Joe Montana.
And
yeah.
Fred Cox,
right.
The kicker, you know, out of Minnesota. Yeah, we all graduated at the same high school.
Yeah.
You know, you remember Ulysses Payne?
Yes.
Yeah, Ulysses Payne's from him and Joe. Ulysses played on that big Mark McGuire basketball team back in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, obviously worked your way up through the Reds minor league system. Got to Indianapolis and Triple A club. I guess Vern Rapp was your manager
right,
there.
Right, yeah.
And guys like me that, you know, played baseball in high school and stuff, I really can't imagine this, but what was it like when Vern Rapp came to you and said, you're going to the big league club?
Well, you know, there was a little story behind that. It wasn't a day off, but it was a, you know, early day, and I decided I was going to go to the movies. And we were in Des Moines, Iowa. And I went to the movies. I was watching Hercules the Unchained. I remember that real well. And the manager of the theater, they had sent word. You know, Vern found out I was at the theater, so they had sent word over there. And the manager came in, and he yelled my name out. And I went up and talked to him. He said, you got to go back to the hotel because your manager wants to see you. I didn't know what it was about. I had no idea. I said, I know I didn't do anything. So yeah. I said, I'll just go back and find out. When I got back there, Vern said, congratulations. You're going to the big leagues. And I think it was me, Will McEnany, Tommy Carroll,
Ed
Armbrister were the four guys that went up that day. Mm-hmm. You know, and George came up on the first later.
That was 1973.
Yeah. 1973, yep.
You remember your first major league at bat?
First major league at bat, I think I grounded out to second, and it was against Rick Wise.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And then the next one, I think I hit a double down the left field line. It was my first hit.
Yeah. Obviously, I mean, you were a member of the Great Eight, of the Big Red Machine.
That I can't understand. I mean, they talk about that, and it surprises me that, you know, we're looking at the Great Eight now. It used to be just the Big Red Machine,
right.
You know.
But now we're
so
looking
strange
at the Great Eight.
Yeah.
Well, but if you look at that lineup, I mean, 1 through 8, I mean, in my humble opinion, that's the best lineup that was ever put out on a baseball field. I mean, you know, you could argue about that all day long. I mean, what was it like in those days?
I mean, well, I was, like I said, I was the youngest of all of them. Mm-hmm. I guess I was the baby, you know, and I had to abide by a lot of the rules those guys set forth. But playing with them, you know, I mean, you know, when we came through the minor league system, the Red system was built on fundamentals, period. It wasn't anything else. You made mistakes, you weren't going to make very many, okay? You weren't going to make the mental mistakes, and you're always going to hit the cutoff man as an outfielder, you know, do what you're supposed to do. And They prided themselves, the Reds organization did, on the fundamental system. And in other words, being fundamentally sound. And when you get to the big leagues, you have Sparky Anderson. Mm-hmm. And Sparky was no nonsense. He didn't believe if you didn't know how to play the game, he was not planning on teaching you in the big leagues. He was there to win. So we understood that concept. We understood that, you know, go out, play hard, do your job, do what you're supposed to do. But see, my biggest thing was to have fun. And the one that taught me more about that was my older brother, Jimmy. You know, Jim Bell was his name.
Yeah.
We called him Squeeze. But he's the one that taught me that, and my mother taught me that. So I always played every game that you play, and there are games. You know, you're playing football, it's a game, basketball, the same, and then baseball was a game. But I played it as a game, and I had a lot of fun with it. And any incidents that happen out on the field, you know, you giggled about it. If it looked funny, you know, you had to. You know, so those are the things we did. But playing on that team was strictly business. Yeah. I mean, once we got between the white lines, we were out there to beat you. You know, there wasn't going to be very many teams. And we prided ourselves that we knew as soon as we stepped out on the field that we're going to beat you. And we carried ourselves that way. I mean, we just did whatever we had to do in order to win games. And everybody talks about the Great Eight and stuff, but I always felt this way about our pitching staff. Our pitching staff always gave us an opportunity to win games. And I think that was the biggest thing any pitching staff can do. They always gave us an opportunity the 7th, 8th, and 9th inning to win a game. And I always probably, you know, love talking about Jack Billingham and Don Gullett and Gary Nolan, Freddie Norman, and in the bullpen with Barbone and Clay Carroll and Eastwick and McEnany. So
sometimes those guys get overlooked.
They all do. I mean, that's all. You know, everyone talks about the Great Eight, and I always look. Hey, there still was 25 guys out there.
Yeah,
you know,
it was great 25.
Played. Yeah, and I thought that was a 25-man team, but we played it as a team. You know, but everybody singled us out because of our offense. Mm-hmm. And how we played the game, you know. I mean, no one, and you know, most pitchers knew the 7th, 8th, 9th inning. If we're down by 1 or 2, that we had a chance to win it. So, but we played hard and we had fun doing it.
That team just, had this supreme confidence in itself, it seemed like.
Well, that was the big thing.
Watching
yeah.
it, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The confidence level was sky high. I mean, we there was no limit we couldn't do, you know, and especially out on the field. And there was no deficit that we didn't think we could overcome. So yeah. That's how we played.
What was the clubhouse like for the Big Red Machine team?
Clubhouse was relaxed.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you had Pete Rose, Joe Morgan sitting there, and I came down. I was sitting in kind of in the middle. Me and George sat on the other end. Dries was next to me. And then we had a couple of the younger kids. Bench was in one corner, but, you know, he had two big lockers. So did Joe and Pete.
Yeah.
And Doggy was at the other end with the Latin players. But it was a fun clubhouse. I mean, yeah. And the big prankster was Tony Perez.
Yeah.
And Doggy kept everybody going, though. He kept... he was an amazing guy because, you know, you sit there and you listen to him. He still doesn't. His English is still not that good after all these years in the States.
Yeah, that's right.
He's fun to listen to. But
yeah,
you know, and his he always played by example. He'll go out and he'll tell you, I'll drive in the runs. You know, you get on base, I drive the runs. And like I said, that's how we played. That's how we went out with our – took care of our business, and like I said, Doggy and Pete and Joe and JB, George is, you know, George came, when he came and put that and anchored down that four slot, you know, then we were pretty good after that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Tony used to, I've read that he, every once in a while, he'd get it on Morgan or something.
Oh, he stayed on,
that.
You know, he made those, the two big guys, he can get on the three big guys.
Hey, I'm here to drive you in.
Yeah, that's what he would tell us. You know, he always told me, all you had to do is get first, I'll drive you in from first base.
Yeah. And obviously the back-to-back world championships.
That solidified it. Yeah.
Rings, you know, which set 1975 World Series was an amazing thing. Do you think that was the greatest World Series of all time?
To be honest with you, I could not tell you because I don't even watch the World Series that much.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, if we're not in it, I don't watch it.
Yeah.
You know? But it was a fun series for us.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're talking about the rain delays and
and
then all the things that happened. We watched the game six was probably the most amazing game. We had the worst swing in the history of baseball with Bernie Carbo. And the very next swing, he hits a three-run, the perfect swing, hits a three-run home run to tie the game. And then at the end of it, you know, bottom of the 12th, Fisk hits that home run to win the game. And, you know, I think Boston fans still think they won that series. That's, but you got to play seven.
Well, yeah, I have a lot of Boston Red Sox fans as friends, and they somehow think that World Series ended at game six. But there was a game seven.
No, there was a game seven, and we beat them 3-2 in the game seven.
Exactly. So, thanks to Joe Morgan's
You know, but I mean, I get used to remind a lot of them. Because, I would look in, like, catalogs and when I'm flying and stuff.
Yeah.
And they'll have the Boston Red Sox hat on sale, the 1975 World Series hat. I'm saying they didn't win the World Series in 75, but everyone believes, you know, on that home run, that's all they show is that
that's
Boston
it.
Won that home run. I mean,
everybody,
won that series.
Everybody
and they
forgets
didn't.
Game seven.
Everyone forgot the game seven because it was, I think game six was so exciting, I guess.
You know?
I mean, it was a fun game to watch, a fun game to play in, and we just had a lot of fun. And we knew the next day we still had one more game, and they weren't going to beat us in that game. We knew that when we went
but
back
you were behind
the next
in
day.
That game.
Mm-hmm.
And
we came back.
Behind.
Yeah, we came back and beat them.
I remember reading the story. I don't know if it's true or not, but Pete running up and down the bench, just, you know, we're not going to get beat by these guys.
No, I mean, Pete always, you know, Pete was going to tell everybody we're not going to get beat by him, you know. So, but we had our confidence level, we knew we weren't going to get beat by him.
Is that right?
Yeah, we knew that.
Yeah. 76 obviously was a lot different. I mean, you know, you're going up against the Yankees in the World Series. You sweep them.
Mm-hmm.
You scored the winning run in, I think, game two, was it?
It was game two. Yeah, game two against, was Catfish?
Yeah.
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 It was a Doggy hit a single.
Right.
And I scored the winning
scored
run.
The winning.
The beginning of it was Stanley makes an error. He overthrows the ball because I made him arrest him because I should have had a hit, but they gave Stanley an error, and I went in the second, and Doggy drove me in and I scored the winning run in the second game too. But Catfish was tough that day.
Yeah, well, and that was a good Yankees team, but
yeah,
the Reds swept them. I mean, was that How satisfying was that? I mean, was
well, we were just going to play. I mean, we knew our confidence level was so high. Mm-hmm. And the way we played, I mean, you sit and watch that series, you know, you had Pete standing in front of Mickey Rivers, telling him to bunt, and Mickey wouldn't bunt, you know. Then you had Thurman Munson, who had 14 or 15 hits in that series, who had I think he set a record in base hits in that series.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I mean, they had to score runs, and we knew JB got hot. And the first DH in the history of National League was Dan Dreesen that year, and Danny had an outstanding series. Yeah. So it was all fun. I mean, we just enjoyed everything with that one. Because Pete and I think Pete had two hits in 17 at-bats, and I had one hit in 17 at-bats. So the first three guys weren't that tough in that series. But Bench, Tony, and George and Dan Dreesen took over.
But you wrote in the book about Sparky Anderson and about the relationship that you had with him. I mean, there were long periods of time where you just didn't communicate with him, didn't you? I mean, well, what was your relationship with Sparky?
Sparky never said too much to me.
Yeah.
Okay. And some of the things that happened, you know, during the course of the year, I mean, there was a situation that, you know, I just hit a home run, I think, off of Don Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, a lot of reporters, when they get information from certain people, they want to get a reaction from a player. And the situation was, I just hit a home run, you know, to win a game. And one of the reporters walked into me and he said, did you know, Sparky said, they don't know you that well. They'll get you next year. And I'm thinking, you know, what do you mean they'll get me next year? I mean, we're still playing 73, you know.
Right.
And George Foster was standing next to me, and George said, what did you do to Sparky? I said, George, I said, the only thing I'm doing is playing. You know, I'm enjoying playing the game. That's all I was doing. So, there were certain things that when it was a history of from 73, 74, 75, and 76.
Yeah.
That I'd went through a lot of different changes with Sparky. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I just stayed away. You know, I mean, I just never said too much to him. And, you know, I just played.
Just do your job.
Yeah, just did my job. And the things that were happening were surprising. Just like the last day of the batting title. Everybody thought I set out. You know, I didn't have any control. You know, I mean, if you sit there and think, it was only my second full year in the big leagues. And at that time, players didn't have very much control of what's going on. Sparky had all the control.
Mm-hmm.
And when he told me that I wasn't playing, I said, I just went 0-for-5. And I was talking to him, you know, I said, I just went 0-for-5 the night before against Phil Negro, who threw a one-hitter. And I knew that, you know, if I come out and get one or two hits, there's no way Bill Matlock can beat me.
Yeah.
But he figured he was protecting me. And, you know, I mean, that's how Sparky thinks sometimes. He figures, you know, he would rather protect his players, and I would rather play.
Yeah, you know? Right.
And he didn't play me that day.
Well, how did you see your role on that lineup? I mean, what?
Well, my role was to get on base. That was my role, on base. And my biggest role was to move Pete from first to third.
Yeah.
You know, and I was one of the few guys that can pull the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Consistently, didn't make it was outside, inside, didn't make any difference, and I can hit that hole, and now you got first and third, nobody out.
Yeah,
you know, and that's how we played. You know, once I knew Pete would get on base, and I knew I had that hole, I was gonna pull the ball. It didn't matter if you throwing a hard sink or whatever. I was gonna pull the ball through the hole, and the AstroTurf helped me a little bit too. All I had to do was bounce it a couple of times, and it would go through that hole. And then Pete was the best at going from first to third, so. You know, you're looking at Joe Morgan. I think he had like one year, he had like 17 sacrifice flies. And that's kind of unheard of sometimes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, that's what it was. You get Pete on first, I'll move him over with a single through the hole. And then you have first and third, nobody out. And Joe would come up and hit a sacrifice fly or he'd get a single. Depends.
Just briefly, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about you ended up with the Yankees. At a period of time when the Yankees were like having a merry-go-round of managers.
They were having a big problem.
What was that period
well,
like?
Well, it was that 4.5 years in New York was kind of, for me, it was more of a learning experience.
Yeah.
Coming from Cincinnati, it was very conservative, and we knew we were one here in Cincinnati. And, you know, they had just come off the World Series in 81. Mm-hmm. You know, and they, you know, they had told me, well, I was promised, and I sit there with Steinbrenner, that they were going to sign Reggie Jackson. And they said that they were going to sign Reggie, and that was the reason why I let the Reds trade me to the Yankees, because, you know, they would get, they wanted, they asked me what team would I go to. I said I wouldn't go to any other team but the New York Yankees, mm-hmm. you know, period.
Yeah.
And, okay, so Wagner had talked to my agent, and they had 72 hours to make a deal, or if not, I could still go free agent. And I knew the Reds did not want me in the National League. I knew that for a fact. They didn't want me to stay in the National League. So they made the deal. Now, the first year there, we had Bob Lemon. And the first 2 weeks, Bob Lemon was gone.
Yeah.
You know, now I think they hired either Billy Martin or Clyde King. I'm not sure which one. But I know I had Clyde King twice, Billy twice, Yogi twice.
Right.
Billy, Bob Lemon for 2 weeks. And then I had Gene Michaels. And then the last manager I had was Lou Piniella.
Right.
You know, in 86. And halfway through the year, I was having a good year, and they traded me to the
Braves.
To the Braves, yeah.
Yeah. And when you came back to the Reds, obviously, you know, you were there in the late 80s and the 1990 season. And when you left the Reds, I mean, it was kind of under unusual circumstances.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what happened? I mean,
well, the circumstances was, you know, Lou, Danny Jackson, I think, had a chest cold.
Yeah.
And he was a little stiff. And, you know, he said he couldn't throw. And Dr., I think his name was Doc Lahan, was the team physician at that time. And he had told Lou that Danny would be all right. I'd just give him some antibiotics and he would be fine. And Lou wanted the roster spot. Didn't matter what, he wanted to bring a left-hand pitcher up. So he called me in the office and he said, you have three choices. You know, we either will release you, you go to AAA and we can bring you back, or you can retire. So I said, if you release me, I know a few of the young kids would be a little upset. And I was close to O'Neill and Larkin and Eric Davis, you know. I was pretty close to those kids. And I knew they wouldn't be upset, but I know they wouldn't let the team that they'd play, you know, they weren't gonna play. But they put their names on they put my number on their hats and my shoes and all that. You know, I was very, very touched about that situation, what they did. So anyway, I told Lou, I said, well, I know if I retired that I wouldn't get my money. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you release me, like I said, there would be some kids would be upset. And the last thing was, if they send me to Indy, and I said, what do I have to prove in Indianapolis? You know, I mean, it's just simple as that. What do I have to prove in Indy? So I told him, I said, if I retire, I wouldn't get my money. He said, no. He said, I'll get your money. So he talked to the general manager, and I'm trying to think of the general manager.
Bob Quinn?
Bob Quinn. That's who it was. Yeah. Bob Quinn was the manager. And Bob said, it's fine.
Yeah.
So I called the meeting, and I announced to the kids that, you know, I was going to retire as of effective today. And, you know, I went on home, and I was sitting there, I think it was Saturday afternoon, and they had Tim McCarver was on Game of the Week. And he's talking about it, and he said to me, on the air, he said, ooh, wouldn't it be nice if he had a chance to go play with his son up in Seattle? And, you know, then they started talking about it, Tim McCarver said, you know, the funny part about that is that to be reinstated, he has to, you know, set out 60 days. And this was at the end of August.
Yeah,
so
there
wouldn't have been no chance of me playing with Junior in September.
Right.
So, you know, I called Brian Goldberg. Brian called Bob Quinn. He called Marge, and they said, we're not going to open up a can of worms. He retired. That's it. So shortly after that, I was still watching television, and I got a call from the National League president, Bill White. And he said, what happened? And I explained to him what happened. He said, you sit there, I'll call you back in 15 minutes. I got a call back in 15 minutes, and he told me they reversed it, and they're going to release you, and you're going to go to Seattle. But I wasn't even thinking about going to Seattle at the time, but I said, I guess that would be the logical place to go would be go to Seattle. And that's how I got there.
And you end up, I think it was August 31st, 1990, when you
played. Yeah, we played
your
together.
First game with Junior,
right?
In the outfield.
Mm-hmm.
That's What was that like? I mean, that's got
to
be.
Still, you know, I had to talk about that. I was so emotional, but I always try to keep my emotions not on my sleeve. You know, I try to make sure it stayed within me and I can control things that are going on around me.
Right.
And we ran out on the field together and he was just grinning. I mean, and I was grinning because I was looking at him and he was the happiest little kid in the world, looked like it. And he's out there playing with his dad.
Yeah.
So he's throwing.
He's in his second year. Then,
yeah, he's in his second year.
Yeah.
And we're throwing back and forth, and I had to look at him. I said, he's only 12 years old. He's only 12 years old. I keep telling myself that. So it ended up, you know, we're playing, and then the first at bat, we come in after the first inning, first at bat, I'm getting ready, and I'm walking up to the plate. I get in there, and all of a sudden from the on-deck circle, I hear somebody say, come on, Dad. And I had to rethink everything. I got out of the box. I looked at him. I shook my head at him a little bit. I said, no, it's like, don't say that.
Then there was September 13th.
14th.
Or 14th, yeah. That's right, yeah. 1990.
Same scenario.
Junior comes to bat, hits one out of the park.
Reversed. I came up first. Yeah, Harold Reynolds was on first base.
Right.
And I got a fastball off of Kurt McCaskill, and I hit it out kind of center field, straightaway center field.
Yeah.
And I'm around the third base, and the first one was going to meet me is him.
Yeah.
And his demeanor changed. You know, he was happy that I hit the home run, but at the same time, you can see the wheels turning. And then his concentration level started. You can see it was going up and up. And Harold and I were walking back, and he said, he's going to try to hit a home run. And I said, he said, yeah, but if he, you know, Harold said, if he does, it'll be a first-time father and son. He'd go back-to-back. And I knew, it's a funny thing, sometimes all these things going, I said, well, I mean, you can tell he's thinking about it, you know. And I didn't think it was going to happen. So when he was 3-0, I said, well, it's not going to work. He's not going to throw him a pitch to hit. And McCaskill threw him a pitch down and away, and he kind of golfed it out of left field. He hit it over Dante Machette's head in the left field. I said, you got to be kidding me. And he, like I said, when he does something and he's determined to do it, at that time when he was that age, he can almost dictate what he wanted to do with a ball or even catch a ball. And, you know, he was grinning. He gave me a big hug. I gave him a hug. And I guess that was what it was. It was history.
Just to wrap up, was there one moment in your career that you're most proud of?
Most proud of I've had so many things that, you know, that I've been so fortunate and blessed about a lot of stuff. I mean, I played in or saw three 300 winners, Gaylord Perry, Tom Seaver, and Phil Negro. Now, I was my first year in the big leagues, the first game I played. And, you know, as a rookie, I was in the game that Hank Aaron hit 714.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting the opportunity to play with Junior. I think the number one thing was probably playing with Junior.
Yeah.
You know, getting that opportunity to run out on the field with him on August 31st, 1990, and the 1975 World Series, playing on that team, those two teams, 75 and 76. But in order, it would probably be the back-to-back home runs, the first time I played with Junior in the 75-76 World Series teams. Yeah.
Well, Ken, you've written a fantastic book. It's called Big Red, Baseball, Fatherhood, and My Life in the Big Red Machine. I really appreciate you coming here and being with us.
I had a good time. Thank you. I'm glad you had me on.
All right. Thanks, sir.